The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Read, but anyway.
Well, thank you for all the training that you've gone through.
Yeah, thank you. And I continue to go through. It's a work in progress for all of us, as we know. We're never finished, are we? Anyone finished? I'm certainly not finished. I feel like I'm just beginning. So lovely to be here with you tonight. Sangha is always lovely. It's just so, so nice, people coming out, and there's so many things you can do with your time, and to come out and meditate and listen to a talk. So on behalf of all beings, all the circles that go out from you, I thank you for spending your time this way. So for tonight's topic, tonight's talk is inspired by a little lovely book called The Way to Love. Very interesting title, no? It's provocative already. The Last Meditations of Anthony DeMello. Anyone familiar with Anthony DeMello out there? Just show of hands. Oh, a few. Okay, great. A few people are. Yeah, lovely. So, and for the rest of you, this would be new and a treat, I hope. It was a treat when I ran across this book. So, The Way to Love. So Anthony DeMello was an Indian Jesuit priest and a psychotherapist and spiritual teacher, writer, public speaker. And he's written many books. This is his last book, The Last Meditations Of. And it's a tiny little book, as you can see from the size of it. And it's made up of little chapters on each topic. And when I ran into this on the bookshelf of a friend of mine who's a practitioner, the name was quite provocative, The Way to Love. Wow, don't we all want to learn the way to love? Would this little book tell me the way to love? Great, so I started to read it, and then he gave it to me afterwards. It's so interesting. So the way he writes, the way this book is structured, each chapter starts with a line from the Bible. And then there's a teaching about it. And as I read it, it sounded Buddhist to me, both Christian and Buddhist. There's somewhere in the book also he teaches the Four Noble Truths, that there are the four truths. He doesn't call them that, but they're exactly there. But in interfaith language, in Christian language. So I wanted to share some of the teachings with you here tonight. They're profound, they're beautiful, and I think they're quite relevant, not just to our lives as individuals, as the way to love, but also to our lives as a society, especially at this time, to not turn our backs, not to fall into despair, not to fall into fear, not to fall into hate, but continue to be open and be with what is difficult and continue to love, both from a personal stance and opening our minds and hearts to people that we disagree with. So I'll leave that there. I'll come back to this. I'm going to leave a footnote to what I just said on the societal level. So bear with me. Stay with me. We'll stay posted. We'll come back to it. So I'd like to start by reading part of a chapter called... Marks here. Okay, here we go. All right. The title of this little chapter is Be Awake. Does that sound familiar to anybody? Be awake? Great. And it starts with, blessed are those servants whom the master finds awake when he comes. Luke 12:37. Everywhere in the world, people are in search of love, for everyone is convinced that love alone can save the world. Love alone can make life meaningful and worth living. But how very few understand what love really is and how it arises in the human heart. It is so frequently equated with good feelings towards others, but benevolence or nonviolence or service. But these things in themselves are not love. Okay, interesting. Let's see what else he says. Love springs from awareness. Ah, love springs from awareness. Does that sound familiar to anyone here? Practicing awareness, mindful awareness. It is only inasmuch as you see someone as he or she really is here and now, and not as they are in your memory or your desire or in your imagination or projection, that you can truly love them. Otherwise, it is not the person that you love, but the idea that you have formed of this person, or this person as the object of your desire, not as he or she is in themselves. Therefore, the first act of love is to see this person or this object, this reality, as it truly is. And this involves the enormous discipline of dropping your desires, your prejudices, your memories, your projections, your selective way of looking. A discipline so great that most people would rather plunge headlong into good actions and service than submit to the burning fire of this asceticism. So the first ingredient of love is to really see the other. Let's sit with that for a moment. That is profound, to equate love and the first step to love, to just see, to clearly see. To clearly see, be aware of the object of our love, of our beloved. Not as we remember them, not as we want them to be, not as we want them to do for us. But being aware, taking them as they are, just seeing them just as they are, the act of seeing, seeing clearly. The second ingredient is equally important: to see yourself, to ruthlessly flash the light of awareness on your motives, your emotions, your needs, your dishonesty, your self-seeking, your tendency to control and manipulate. This means calling things by their name, no matter how painful the discovery and the consequences. This is very interesting too, to bring the light of awareness to ourselves, to our motives. I did this a few years ago, almost a decade ago, and it was an enlightening experience. It was inspired actually at the time not by this book, but by another book. It's by the Harvard Negotiation Project people, and the book is called Difficult Conversations. And in that book, it's actually a wonderful book. If you have any difficult conversations with anybody, and we all have difficult conversations through our lives, it's a wonderful book because, again, to me, that's a Buddhist book. It talks about examining your own intentions, because a lot of times we go into situations, well, I'm in the right, I'm, you know, I. We don't see our own prejudices. We don't see ourselves clearly at all. We are so fixed. And part of it is because we don't have a lot of awareness. We're just fixed in our view about ourselves. And part of it is this equipment that we have. There are lots of psychological research studies showing that people have a really, really hard time seeing themselves clearly. They have a really hard time. Subjects are put in situations over and over again where they get to judge other people, on, for example, on their generosity, and they're given some money to give away at the end of the experiment, and they say, oh, other people would do it this way, but I would do it this way, but they don't. It's just there's so many ways in which we don't see ourselves clearly. And so knowing that, it's not that we are bad, it's just the bias that every human being has. We have this bias of seeing ourselves in the best light ever and seeing other people in not so great light. Anyone can identify with this? Anybody? We do that all the time. And it's so humbling. It's so humbling to see that when we actually wake up to it. And we see that. So going back to this book, the Difficult Conversations, the book is wonderful in trying to going into a difficult conversation, trying to see, for example, if there is any hurt, trying to see the difference between the what the hurt was and the attributed intention that we give to the other person. Because the effect of it on us, the effect of a word or an action, is different from usually the intended action from the other person, the intended intention they had. Similarly, the book invites us to really look into our own intentions going into a situation. So about a decade ago, I was reading the book, and I was in a relationship at the time. And I start to become really, really curious about my own motives. Really curious. And I was shining this line of awareness. I think I went a little too far because the light was a little too harsh. There wasn't too much gentleness. So if you do this, I invite you to have more gentleness and kindness. So but the beginning of my inquiry was good. So I was really curious. And I would see my mind come up with an action or a thought, like, well, yeah, I want him to do this because, you know, it's good for us, it's good. I'm like, really? Like, let's. So then I would really try to dissect the intentions, and I would see that the intentions were mixed, were not as pure as I took them to be. And that was so sobering and a big dose of humility was served on my plate. That I always took my motives to be pure and I'm kind and I want the best for the other person and the best for the... Wow, okay, the motives are mixed. Maybe it's not so bad, you know, for me to want, you know, somebody to like me or this or that, but these are all mixed motives that we don't quite see. We always think, oh, we want the best. Well, no, maybe, again, not to be too harsh on ourselves, because many of us want to be liked, or there are all these mixed motivations that we have, but just to see them, just to see what they are, what these intentions are, so we're not duping ourselves. I mean, if we're duping ourselves, we're hopeless, right? We're hoping we're duping everybody else too, and unintentionally. It's that ignorance that so we talk so much about in Buddhism. So I like to read another part of this book for you. Okay, so this chapter is called The Mountain of Prayer, and it starts with, and after he had dismissed the crowds, he went up on the mountain by himself to pray. Matthew 14:23. Has it ever occurred to you that you can only love when you are alone? What does it mean to love? It means to see a person, a thing, a situation as it really is and not as you imagine it to be, and to give it the response it deserves, You cannot love what you do, not even you cannot love what you do not even see. And what prevents you from seeing your concepts, your categories, your prejudices and projections, your needs and attachments, the labels you have drawn from your conditioning and from your past experience. Seeing is the most arduous thing a human being can undertake. I like the weight he's giving it. Seeing is the most arduous thing a human being can undertake. And I think by this he means clearly seeing. Again, that's what we teach, that's what we practice. Clearly seeing in this practice, to see clearly, to see things as they are, to see things as they are. Seeing is the most arduous thing a human being can undertake, for it calls for a disciplined, alert mind, whereas most people would much rather lapse into mental laziness than take the trouble to see each person and thing anew, the present moment freshness. A thing anew in present moment freshness. So it's that freshness, it's what it's called the beginner's mind, to go into situations, to meet every situation, to meet every person that we know and want to love with that freshness of meeting them exactly where what is arising in the moment without our prejudices, our expectations, what we want from them. A lot of times, again, from my own life, with the light of awareness, in a lot of relationships, they're laden with what I want from the other person, and it's taken many years of practice for me to see that and lighten up on that, and it's work in progress. But to really examine in so many relationships, there is something we want from the other person. We want them to like us. We want them to love us. Maybe in the work situation, we want them to promote us. Maybe, you know, we want. So all we bring all these prejudices. Maybe when we serve somebody, we want to feel good that we're serving. Last Thursday, Kim Allen gave a beautiful talk here about her experiences as a spiritual caregiver as she goes into a hospital, and she's just present with what is, just receiving what is, being present to what comes up in her own heart and mind in the present moment when she's interacting with someone, but also just going into the situation with the training that she has, but being present for whatever the situation calls for, not having the preconceived notions of I'm going to do this and I'm going to meet this person and they're going to be sick and maybe they're dying, and just knowing nothing, meeting the person, meeting the situation fresh and new. It opens so much possibility. Ask yourself, is there a situation in your life right now that could benefit from putting down, from letting go, from the history, the memory, and just meeting it new, meeting this person, meeting this situation with a fresh mind, a beginner's mind. I read a few more lines, or actually a couple of paragraphs. To drop your conditioning in order to see is arduous enough, but seeing calls for something more painful still, the dropping of the control that society exercises over you. A control whose tentacles have penetrated to the very roots of your being, so that to drop it is to tear yourself apart. If you wish to understand this, think of a little child that is given a taste for drugs. As the drug penetrates the body of the child, it becomes addicted, and its whole being cries out for the drug. To be without the drug is so unbearable a torment that it seems preferable to die. Now, this is exactly what society did to you. When you were a child, you were not allowed to enjoy the solid, nutritious food of life, work and play, and the company of people, and the pleasures of the senses and the mind. You were given a taste for the drug called approval, appreciation, attention, the drug called success, prestige, power. Having got a taste for these things, you became addicted and began to dread their loss. You felt terror at the prospect of failure, of mistakes, of the criticism of others. So you became cravingly dependent on people and lost your freedom. I love that. So you became cravingly dependent on people and lost your freedom. Others now have the power to make you happy or miserable. Isn't that interesting? How true is that? Others now have the power to make you happy or miserable. And much as you now hate the suffering this involves, you find yourself completely helpless. There is never a minute when, consciously or unconsciously, you are not attuned to the reaction of others, marching to the drum of their demands. When you are ignored or disapproved of, you experience a loneliness so unbearable that you crawl back to people to beg for the comfort known as support, encouragement, reassurance. To live with people in this state involves never-ending tension, but to live without them brings the agony of loneliness. You have lost your capacity to see them clearly as they are, and to respond to them accurately, because mostly your perception of them is clouded by your need to get your drug. Whew. Pretty strong dose, hey? Yeah. When I read that years ago, boy, did it resonate. We are in this web of approval and wanting to be liked and wanting this and wanting that. And it's just to clearly see that. And it takes a lot of practice and maturing to see clearly where we are entangled, where we are attached, when it tugs at our heart, when it really tugs at our heart. T.S. Eliot said, teach us to care and not to care. So to care about other people, but not to care so much about what they think about us. There is so much freedom. There is so much freedom. And again, not, I don't mean to be callous about other people's feelings. I don't mean that at all. But there is a freedom in not seeking approval all the time. Not wanting to be liked. Not wanting that drug. I can tell you, in transparency and honesty, it's been a maturing process for me as a teacher in training, and it continues to be a learning process, to want to be of service when I give a talk and not to care if people don't like it or if people get up to leave. I would be so self-judgmental, and I would be in so much pain when people got up to leave, or I wouldn't get enough questions at the end. But I'm learning not to care, because really, it's to be of service. And I give up my freedom as a human being. I give my power to everybody else if I'm dependent on your approval tonight. Ooh, ouch, what a painful place to be. Right? And instead, being in this free flow, trying to offer the best I can, and it's okay. not dependent. You know, my peace, my stillness, my happiness is not dependent on your approval. I hope I can be of service. So it's alive. This is alive. It's not hypothetical. It's alive for me, and I trust for you too. Yes? Yes. Yes. I'd like to read some more, if I may. Another chapter. Let's see. I realize my eyes are getting worse. It's age. Oh my goodness. Okay. Wow. Okay. All right, this chapter is called Bring in the Poor. And it starts with Luke 14:21, which is, "The householder in anger said to the servant, 'Go out quickly to the streets and lanes of the city and bring in the poor and maimed and blind and lame.'" Think of someone you dislike, someone you generally avoid, because his or her presence generates negative feelings in you. Imagine yourself in this person's presence now and watch negative emotions arise. Okay, do that, would you? Let's do that together. Let's close our eyes for a moment. Okay, got it? Okay, great. You are, quite conceivably, in the presence of someone who is poor, crippled, blind, or lame. I love the way he interprets that, the way he takes that. Now understand that if you invite this person, this beggar from the streets and alleys into your home, that is, into your presence, he, she will make you a gift that none of your charming, pleasant friends can make you, rich as they are. He or she is going to reveal yourself to you and reveal human nature to you, a revelation as precious as any profound, as any found in Scripture. For what will it profit you to know all the Scriptures if you do not know yourself and so live the life of a robot? The revelation that this beggar is going to bring will widen your heart till there is room in it for every living creature. Can there be a finer gift than that? Now take a look at yourself reacting negatively and ask yourself the following question: am I in charge of this situation, or is the situation in charge of me? That is the first revelation. With it comes the second. The way to be in charge of this situation is to be in charge of yourself, which you are not. How does one achieve this mastery? All you have to do is to understand that there are people in this world who, if they were in your place, would not be negatively affected by this person. They would be in charge of the situation, above it, not subject to it as you are. Therefore, your negative feelings are caused not by this person, as you mistakenly think, but by your programming. Here is the third and major revelation. See what happens when you really understand this. So it's our difficult people, as we call them, we don't call them so much our enemies in this practice, our difficult people are really our best teacher, because they reveal the work that continues, that needs to be done in our heart and mind. You know, we can be happy and kind and gentle and blissed out and think, okay, I'm done. You know, I'm done with this path. You know, I'm enlightened. You know, I'm good to go. And then you come across your difficult person, your beggar, your poor, your blind. And there comes the conditioning, the patterns. You realize there's more work to do. There's more work to do. And it's not so much that person not something about them specifically, but the way you're reacting. In the practice of metta and loving kindness, we practice starting with the easy person, feeling goodwill, our care, our love for someone for whom it's easy to feel our care for. And then we expand then to a neutral person, and then to the difficult person, and then all beings. I'm going to read a little more before I say the next thought, because I think he has a nice way of saying it. Having received these revelations about yourself, listen to this revelation concerning human nature. This behavior, this trait in the other person that causes you to react negatively, do you realize that he or she is not responsible for it? You can hold on to your negative feelings only when you mistakenly believe that he or she is free and aware and therefore responsible. But whoever... Actually, this is a really good point here. You can hold on to your negative feelings only when you mistakenly believe that he or she is free and aware and therefore responsible. But whoever did evil in awareness, whoever did evil in awareness, the ability to do evil or to be evil, we don't use evil in Buddhism, we use unskillful, but anyway, we use evil now since he says it. The ability to do evil or be evil is not freedom, but a sickness, for it implies a lack of consciousness and sensitivity. Those who are truly free cannot sin, as God cannot sin. This poor person here in front of you is crippled, blind, lame, not stubborn and malicious, as you so foolishly thought. Understand this truth. Look at it steadfastly and deeply, and you will see your negative emotions turn into gentleness and compassion. Suddenly you have room in your heart for someone who was consigned to the streets and alleys by you, by others and by you. Now you will realize that this beggar came to your home with an alms for you, the widening of your heart in compassion and the release of your spirit and freedom. Where before you used to be controlled, these persons had the power to create negative emotions in you, and you went on and you went out of your way to avoid them. Now you have the gift of freedom to avoid no one, to go anywhere. When you see this, you will notice how the feeling of compassion in your heart has been added the feeling of gratitude to this beggar who is your benefactor. And another new and accustomed feeling, you actually feel a desire to seek out the company of these growth-producing, crippled, blind, and lame people. The way someone who has learned to swim seeks water. Because each time you are with them, where before you used to feel the oppression of tyranny and negative feelings, you can now actually feel an ever-expanding compassion and the freedom of the skies. The point that he's making here is such a profound one. People don't do unwholesome actions, which he calls evil. People don't hurt each other if they're aware, if they're conscious, if they're conscientious. It takes so much ignorance, it takes so much delusion to hurt somebody else. I'll venture off for a moment and tell you I've had a fascination about NDEs, near-death experiences that many thousands, hundreds and thousands of people seem to have had and report from various countries. So near-death experiences where people seem to, their heart stops, their various accounts. But anyway, without getting into too much detail, there's something that's interesting that I want to offer you as a thought experiment. Whether or not you believe in near-death experiences or not, let's leave that to a don't-know mind. We don't know. But let me just offer you something as a thought experiment of something that over and over I've read in the accounts of people who have had this kind of an experience. And that is, their life flashes before them. Their entire life flashes before them in ways that when they wake up from, you know, when their heart, you know, they go, their heart is resuscitated, then they come back. They say that their whole life has flashed before them, and they have re-experienced everything that they have done, not just from their perspective, but from the perspective of everybody who was affected by their action. And they could feel, in ways they cannot explain, rapidly feeling how their actions affected everyone else. And that in that state, there wasn't anybody who judged them. There wasn't a God that judged them, oh, you did bad, now you go to hell. But they judged themselves. They were so, it was so painful when the veil was lifted, the veil of delusion was lifted from their eyes to see how their actions affected everybody else. It was so painful for them that they regretted, that regret, that remorse was such a strong feeling that many people who have had near-death experiences, they're changed forever. And that is often a pivotal moment. So with that thought experiment, offering that to you, whether or not it's true, who knows, don't know mind. But as a thought experiment, if the veil was lifted from our eyes, and if you experienced how your action, how your interaction with another person affected them, how they felt today, what would you do differently? How would you live your life differently? I want to leave you with that question as you move on, move through the world this week, to try that on for size, if you remember. We have 1 minute left. Let's just sit together and let the words sink.